Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from The Voice of America. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear the English Expression Teaching Series, Words and Their Stories, with Ana Mateo, as well as a story about progress in HIV research from Susan Shand. Later, Faith Lapidus, Larry West, and Tony Riggs bring us the American History Series, Making of a Nation. But first, the Higher Education Report. Moving from one place to another is always an adventure. No amount of research can prepare you for the surprises you will find in the new place. This is often the case with international students in the United States. Around major American holidays, international students often find themselves in uncharted waters, which they learn to navigate with time. Come the fourth Thursday in November, many newly arrived students experience the U.S. holiday of Thanksgiving for the first time. My first Thanksgiving was in Montana. My experience of it was fascinating, said Richmond Danso of Ghana. The whole process of preparing the food, the merrymaking around it, and everything was just fascinating, he said. Danso is a doctoral candidate in political science at Howard University in Washington, D.C. Other international students look at Thanksgiving as a chance to rest up. Dan Shengquan of China, a master's degree candidate at New York University, told VOA his first memory of the holiday was having a few days off from school.
It was like end of semester day off, having time to chill, said Dan Shengquan, who admitted knowing very few people on arriving at school. But these days, he added, I get a chance to visit my friend's family and join their family party. Around Christmas, many international students do not have money to travel back to their home country, so they spend the holiday in the States. Those with extended family in the country go to stay with them for the celebrations. When it's Christmas, I go back to my family in New York, said Daniel Mensa of Ghana. Mensa is in his final year at the George Washington University in Washington. He is specializing in economics. International students with no extended family in the States often celebrate Christmas with their American friends and their families. Lourdes Fernando from Sri Lanka is a doctoral candidate in biology at Howard University. She told VOA she celebrates Christmas with her best friend, whose family lives in Maryland. So I'll go there, she said. Her family is there, so I'll go for dinner or something. Some international students who are Christian attend church services in the States. During the holiday season, they join with their church family in celebrating Christmas. Personally, I think it's more the family element. I have a church family here, so the excitement of spending Christmas, we go to church and we stay together, said Sally Amankwa of Ghana.
She is a master's candidate in sociology at American University in Washington. The act of giving gifts to adults at Christmas and even the holiday itself is foreign to some students. Selina Anosike of Nigeria is a doctoral candidate in biology at Howard University. She has been living in the United States for about 2 years. Anosike says she was shocked when family members living in the States gave her gifts for Christmas. "I remember my first Christmas here. I really did not know anything about the gift sharing. I just realized my uncle got me a gift, my aunt got me a gift, and my cousin got me a gift. But I did not get anyone a gift," she said. "It was a new experience for me because back home as kids, while you're still young, your parents will get you a new outfit, new shoes, new dresses for Christmas, up until high school. But by the time you get to college, no one cares anymore," she added. For some international students, Christmas is not a holiday they celebrate in their home country.
"We don't really do Christmas in China," said Bua Wang of China. He is a master's candidate in business analytics at American University. Wunta Kiasan of Myanmar is studying computer science at Howard University. He told VOA that the idea of celebrating Christmas is new to him. "Since we don't actually celebrate Christmas back home, it's like a new experience, you know," he said. During the 3 to 4 weeks break between school terms, some international students take time to explore the United States. "Usually, I go to other places in the States, traveling with my friends," Wang said. "For this year, I plan to go to Denver to snowboard for my Christmas holiday." Other students do a mix of things over winter break. They spend the holiday working, meeting up with friends, and having fun. "Now, as a graduate student, it's always work because, you know, research is time-consuming," Lourdes Fernando said. "So I rarely take a break, even though it's a break for the school." I'm Dorothy Gundy.
And I'm Pete Musto.
Now, the VOA Learning English Program, Words and Their Stories. Everyone probably knows, when we wash something, we make it clean. Just about anything that gets dirty can be washed to become clean again. Or I should say, almost anything. The expression, "it will not wash," seems to say that there are some things that cannot come clean. Let's hear this expression used in a story.
Young Mr. Smith had an idea for his employer. It was an idea for saving money for the company by increasing prices. At the same time, Smith suggested that the company sell goods of less value. If his employer liked the idea, Smith might be given more pay. Perhaps he might even get a better job with the company. Business had been very slow, so Mr. Smith's employer thought a few minutes about the idea. But then she shook her head. "I am sorry, Smith," his employer said. "It just will not wash." Now, the meaning of these English words should be, "it will not get clean." Yet Smith's idea did not have anything to do with making something clean. So why did his employer say, "it will not wash"? Most word experts agree that "it will not wash" means "it will not work." Eric Partridge wrote that the saying probably developed in Britain in the 1800s. Charlotte Bronte used it in a story published in 1849. She wrote, "That willn't wash, miss." Miss Bronte seems to have meant that the dyes used to color a piece of clothing were not good. The colors could not be depended on to stay in the material. In 19th century England, the expression came to mean an undependable statement. It was used mainly to describe an idea, but sometimes it was used about a person. A critic once said of the poet Robert Browning, "He won't wash." The critic did not mean that the poet was not a clean person. He meant that Browning's poems could not be depended on to last. Today, we know that judgment was wrong. Robert Browning still is considered a major poet. But very few people remember the man who said Browning would not wash. Happily for the young employee Smith, his employer wanted him to do well in the company. So the employer talked turkey to him. She said, "Your idea would be unfair to our buyers. Think of another way to save money." A century ago, to talk turkey meant to talk pleasantly. Turkeys in the barnyard were thought to be speaking pleasantly to one another. In recent years, the saying has come to mean an attempt to teach something important. Mr. Smith thought of a better idea after his employer talked turkey to him. He was given an increase in pay. So if your idea will not wash, try talking turkey to yourself and come up with a better idea.
This Words and Their Stories program was written by Jerry Watson, and it was read by Susan Clark. Join us next week when we explore another expression on Words and Their Stories. Until next time, I'm Anna Mateo.
United States health officials are reporting problems in meeting the government's goal of ending the HIV epidemic by the year 2030. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, reports there are about 38,000 new cases of HIV each year across the country. HIV is the name for the human immunodeficiency virus. It can lead to acquired immunodeficiency syndrome, commonly known as AIDS. The CDC says that white Americans at risk of getting HIV are 7 times more likely than blacks or Hispanics to receive a drug shown to be effective at preventing infection. The drug is called PrEP. It has been shown to cut the risk of getting HIV through sex by as much as 99%. The CDC says less than half of at-risk whites use the PrEP. It usually requires doctor's orders. The Trump administration recently announced a plan to provide PrEP free to Americans whose health insurance does not pay for prescription medicines. The medications Truvada and Descovy are made possible in part by a donation from the maker of the drugs, Gilead Sciences. The federal government is paying the manufacturer for several months to distribute the medications. Without insurance, 1 month of the drugs cost between $1,600 and $2,000. CDC officials note that 40% of HIV infections involve people who do not know they have the virus. They urge everyone to get tested, and those who test positive to take daily medications to control the virus. I'm Susan Shand.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. By 1863, America's northern states and southern states had been fighting a bitter civil war for 2 years. Both sides felt the pressure of the costly struggle. The South was beginning to suffer from a lack of supplies and men for its armies. The North was beginning to suffer from a lack of fighting spirit. Larry West and Tony Riggs describe an anti-war movement that was growing.
Many Americans in northern states did not support the war policies of Union President Abraham Lincoln. Some said openly that they did not care who won the war. They just wanted to be left alone. Coal miners in Pennsylvania protested against a law drafting men into the Union Army. They rioted and attacked officials who tried to take them. Soldiers were sent to Pennsylvania to put down the riots. Farmers in Ohio also protested. They refused to be drafted. They attacked soldiers who were sent to arrest them. The worst anti-war riots, however, took place in New York City.
On July 13th, 1863, a crowd formed outside a New York draft office. Inside, Army officials were choosing the names of men who would be taken into the Army. Each name was written on a separate piece of paper. The papers were mixed together in a big box. The officials then began to remove the papers, one at a time. They made a list of the names. These were the men of New York who must go off to fight. On that day, however, the list was never completed. The crowd outside the draft office became louder. There were shouts of protest against the draft and against the Civil War.
Suddenly, a stone crashed through the office window, then another, and another. The army officials escaped, but a policeman inside could not get away. The rioters beat him badly. Then they set fire to the draft office and several buildings nearby. The riots spread across the city. The riot began as a political protest against the draft. Poor men opposed the draft because it permitted rich men to escape military service. The law said a man who was drafted could stay out of the army by doing one of two things. He could pay the government $300, or he could pay another man to serve in his place. If a drafted man could not do either thing, then he must join the army or be shot as a deserter.
In the wartime economy of the North, prices were rising much faster than wages. Even a man with a good job had a difficult time feeding his family. It was impossible for him to pay the government $300 or pay someone else to serve for him in the army. Poor men protested against the law. They said it was unfair. "It's a rich man's war," they cried, "but a poor man's fight. The rich man's money against the poor man's blood."
There was something else that deeply troubled working men in the North. Anti-war activists told them that the war was not being fought to save the Union, but to free Negro slaves. The activists said the freed Negroes would move north and take jobs away from whites. Many men believed this. They said they would not fight.
Then, on July 13th, the angers and fears of working men in New York exploded. Their attack on the draft office that day was just the beginning. The violence lasted 3 days. The rioters beat many policemen to death. They beat, burned, and hanged every Negro they could find. They also killed many whites who tried to protect the Negroes. By the time soldiers stopped the rioting, 1,000 persons had been killed.
The leaders of the anti-war movement in the North were members of the opposition Democratic Party. They wore on their coats a copper penny showing the head of a Native American Indian. This gave them the name Copperheads. One important Copperhead was a former congressman from Ohio, Clement Vallandigham. Vallandigham made a speech criticizing the Union government. He was charged with violating a military law that banned such criticism. He was arrested.
The former congressman was taken before a military court. He objected. He said if he had broken a law, he should be tried by a civilian court. He demanded this as his constitutional right. The military judges rejected his argument. They found him guilty, and they sentenced him to remain in a Union military prison until the end of the war. People throughout the North were angry. Many did not support Clement Vallandigham's ideas, but they supported his right to speak freely. President Lincoln could approve or reject Vallandigham's sentence. His decision would show which issue was more important, the citizens' right to free speech or national security.
Lincoln was a good politician and a smart lawyer. He found an unexpected way to deal with the problem. He neither approved nor rejected the sentence. He changed it. Lincoln ordered Vallandigham to be turned over to the Confederate Army. Then he explained that Vallandigham had not been arrested for criticizing the government. His arrest was made, Lincoln said, because he was trying, with some success, to prevent men from entering the army. He was urging soldiers already in the army to leave it. Mr. Vallandigham was not arrested because he was damaging the political chances of the administration or the interests of the commanding general, but because he was damaging the army, upon which the life of the nation depends. The Confederates welcomed the anti-war leader. They helped him get to Canada. Vallandigham continued his anti-war campaign from there.
President Lincoln was troubled by the anti-war movement and violent opposition to the draft laws. He felt he had to make citizens understand why such laws were necessary. He prepared a speech which explained his thoughts. "There can be no army without men," Lincoln wrote. "Men can be had only with their permission or without it. We can no longer get enough men willingly, so there is a draft. If you dispute this and declare that men are still willing to serve in the army, then prove it by volunteering yourselves in large numbers. Then I will give up the draft."
Lincoln never gave this speech. He felt it was too direct. Instead, he gave a different kind of speech to the people of the Union. "You want peace," Lincoln said, "and you blame me that we do not have it. But how can we get it? There are but three ways possible. First, to put down the Southern Rebellion by force of arms. This I am trying to do. Are you for it? If you are, then we are so far agreed. If you are not for it, a second way is to give up the Union. I am against this. Are you for the Union? If you are, you should say so clearly. If you are not for force and not for dissolving the Union, there only remains some kind of compromise. I do not believe any such compromise is possible."
Politicians urged President Lincoln to investigate the anti-war protests in New York to learn who had led them. He refused. Lincoln believed that starting an investigation would be like lighting a barrel of gunpowder. He already was fighting a bitter struggle against rebels in the South. He did not want to fight the people of the North, too. Southern leaders were pleased with the Copperheads' anti-war movement. Confederate General Robert E. Lee saw it as a sign of weakness in the Northern war effort. He also saw it as an opening for a military victory.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.